Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Clinical Science Podcast. My name is Dr. Panarella. Today I am talking about thrombosis and embolism, which is a follow-up to the last podcast, which was GI obstruction and what happens with GI obstruction. This podcast is a little delayed, unfortunately. I had already recorded it, but this is actually, I'm going to re-record it. Sometimes when you make these podcasts, at least for me, I will do the research necessary and then record the podcast. And then sometimes during the podcast, I just don't like how I sound. I don't like how the information is flowing. So I do re-record the podcast sometimes. I always edit the podcasts because I want to make them as clear and concise and short as possible, actually. But sometimes they just don't feel right. And if they don't feel right, I'm not going to put it out. And this podcast has also been a little delayed because I've been extremely busy at work. I have had some vacation time, but also I had to put my dog down a few weeks back, and she went through, I had talked about it in one of the podcasts, but she had gone through multiple issues. When I'm ready, I'm going to have a podcast about her and what transpired with her, just to fill you in. And I can also talk about euthanasia, which, although it's sometimes a difficult topic to talk about, I think it's good that people understand what's actually happening during euthanasia and how we as veterinarians can make it go as smoothly as possible for the animal and for the people that that love this animal. Anyway, so I'm going to talk today about thrombosis and embolism. And basically, you could just think about them as blood clots. Now, blood clots either stay put, as in a thrombosis, meaning that there's some injury to a blood vessel and the body naturally, platelets, which are circulating throughout the bloodstream, are attracted to the damage to the endothelium, and then fibrin is also laid down to sort of form this sticky substance that actually forms a bandage inside the body. And that process is totally normal. That's how the body is supposed to work. And there's emboli or embolisms, or an embolism, which is singular, which is blood clots that are free floating. There are other causes of emboli or an embolism. It's not just blood clots, but right off the top, you can think about them as blood clots. Okay. So a thrombosis is blood clotting within a blood vessel. We talked about a thrombus is a single blood clot, and thrombi are multiple blood clots. Again, thrombosis, thrombus means it's a blood clot that stays in one place. When blood clots, a thrombus is formed, which is the collection of platelets and fibrin, which I had already mentioned. And that brings me back to the coagulation cascade, which I have a link to in the article. I don't even have it memorized at this point anymore. I did when I was in veterinary school, but that was over 30 years ago. And it's not really necessary when you're a practicing veterinarian to memorize it. What you have to do as a practicing veterinarian is recognize the clinical signs of problems of clotting. And primarily, again, as an aside, what we would normally see would be an animal bleeding either subcutaneously with large amounts of bruising all over the body, or actual hemorrhaging from orifices. So some scenarios where this cascade, the clotting cascade, occurs. I'd mentioned damage to endotheliums. Everybody's had it. Everybody sustained some sort of cut. And if you have a clot to the capillary system, or even a very relatively small artery or vein, the body's clotting mechanisms will work. I am sure some of you have seen some horror movies and some ridiculousness when they cut an artery, and you cannot, because the clotting doesn't effectively work under that high pressure. So when you see blood squirting out, even on an animal, which I have seen, that will not clot by blood. We're talking about very small blood vessels in general. Any blood stasis, which is just slowing down of blood, or blood pooling, which will happen in many cardiac problems. What's called hypercoagulable states, which is a disease process, basically meaning that the body is primed, it's triggered to shower the body with either emboli or just create multiple thrombosis all over the place, such as in a GI obstruction. Endocrinopathies, which are diseases of the endocrine gland. So one of those is the adrenal gland, and we can get hyperadrenocorticism, which can cause clotting throughout the body. Diabetes mellitus. I'm really talking about type 2 diabetes. And then immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, abbreviated IMHA, where the body, usually there's an unknown trigger, but the body then breaks down the red blood cells, and that can also trigger the clotting mechanism. If the clotting process becomes systemic, meaning that instead of it being localized to, let's say, one little area, and it goes throughout the body, this can become uncontrolled. Now the normal clotting process is a very controlled, defined process. The body just wants to take care of this little wound, stop the bleeding, and, you know, brevity's sake, move on. It doesn't want to keep that system going. But sometimes, based on a disease process, the clotting cascade can be triggered over and over and over, and it doesn't shut off. And that leads to a problem called DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation, which this results in microthrombi, really small blood clots showering body. And they'll just be thrown out into the circulation, per se, and they will end up wherever they end up. And that can lead to lots of problems like ischemia, which is lack of blood flow, where the thrombi travel down the blood vessels. And when they hit a place where they can no longer move, blood will not be able to pass that. So you get ischemia, which is lack of blood flow. And then you get tissue death, also called necrosis. And then you also get bleeding. You get the opposite of what you would think, right? The clotting factors are going to clot all the blood. That's not what happens. The clotting factors get used up. And then the body can no longer keep the blood vessels, and the blood vessels end up getting damaged. The endothelial lining of the blood vessels also get damaged. So then you start getting leaky blood vessels, and you just get bleeding from orifices, eyes, nose, ears, genitals, anus, anywhere, you name it. So it's a pretty ugly problem. And that's true. This is all true of cats and dogs. Now, cats have a particular, dogs too, have their own basic particular cardiac diseases, but cats have a disease called abbreviated HCM, or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And these animals are susceptible to thrombosis at the distal aorta. And the aorta is the large pipe that comes out of the left ventricle, supplies blood to the body. And at the back, by the legs and the tail, it's called the iliac arteries, which branch off from the aorta. The iliac arteries supply blood to both legs. There's one on each side. And there's also a coccygeal artery because, of course, most cats have tails. And you can get a blood clot in there called a saddle thrombus, which is just what it sounds like. It's a thrombus that is straddling all those three vessels. Now it can just be one vessel, it can be two vessels, or it can be three vessels. Of course, three vessels would be a catastrophe, because now you have, like I had mentioned, if you get one of these blood clots and it's large enough, it will stop all the blood flow, which is called ischemia, which causes necrosis. And the clinical signs of a saddle thrombus are usually pretty evident. Usually the cats come in dragging their back legs. They're in a tremendous amount of pain. They can have total paralysis of the legs, or paresis, where they only have partial paralysis of the legs. And another common finding is that you can feel is loss of the pulse in the legs. And that's, I talked about palpation, where you can take a couple of fingers, you put them up high on the inside of the thigh, right next to the femur. And if you press sort of, you know, like Goldilocks, sort of in between, if you press too hard, you're going to cut off blood flow. And if you press too lightly, you won't feel it. But if you press moderately hard, you will actually feel, you should be able to feel in a normal cat, the pulsing of the femoral artery, which is a branch of the iliac artery. And if you don't feel that way, you're a skilled person, you can recognize that there's lack of blood flow there. So that's thrombosis. And embolism is biologic material such as a blood clot, which I had mentioned. Could be fat, could be air, We had talked about flicking of the syringe and trying to get air out, and that's an air embolism. And the embolisms travel within the blood vessels. They, and again, end up blocking or obstructing blood flow, which can cause ischemia. Now, remember, this can also be to internal organs. We haven't really touched on that yet, but if you have emboli showering the body, blood is flowing from the heart to the aorta to all the organs of the body, to the brain, to the liver, to the kidneys, to the spleen, to the pancreas. So you can imagine for a moment, if you have multiple emboli traveling through the bloodstream and they go down to the kidney or kidneys, it affects one kidney or both kidneys. If you have enough emboli, you shut down urine production. It's going to be devastating on the animal. The animal is going to be quite ill very rapidly. One small clot, it's called an embolus, multiple or emboli. And commonly, what leads to pulmonary thromboembolism. Now, that's sort of a misnomer in my mind. A thromboembolism means you know there's a thrombus. In animals, without, you know, if an animal dies or is euthanized, you would need a necropsy of all that lung tissue. You would need an, in animals, we don't call it an autopsy, we call it a necropsy. You have to necropsy that animal and section through all the parts of the lung to determine, okay, was this really a thrombus or was this really an embolism? So I don't necessarily like that term. I'd really think better it's a pulmonary emboli. But you can imagine, again, you're sending out little chunks, little pieces of biologic material that are going to travel down the bloodstream, block blood flow, and then you're going to get dyspnea, which is difficulty breathing. Or dyspnea is basically bad breathing. And you're going to see the animal. It's probably going to have rapid respiratory rate. Could have the mouth open, could have the tongue out, it could be gasping for breath. So it's going to cause some changes to the breathing pattern. Now, this is all just clinical, what you could see and hear with a stethoscope. And the disease that commonly causes pulmonary thromboembolism in animals, in dogs, is heartworm disease. It's a whole other separate topic, but basically, it's not really a disease of the heart. Secondarily, it's a disease of the heart. Heartworm disease is actually a disease of the pulmonary artery. And the pulmonary artery comes out of the right ventricle because that is the pipe carrying deoxygenated blood from the heart to the lungs to get oxygenated. Any blood vessel that goes away from the heart is an artery. Any blood vessel that's going to the heart is a vein. There are treatments for thrombosis and emboli. Again, it's going to depend on the severity of the infection and what is the underlying cause of not just the infection per se, but of what the disease process is. Because without attacking the primary problem, you can treat the secondary problem. But if the primary problem is stimulating, let's say, the showering of the body with emboli, if you don't address that primary problem, you're still going to have this ongoing process of clotting and emboli being formed and released. So the core treatment is trying to restore blood flow, and blood flow equals perfusion, right? You want blood flowing as it should normally flow to, for example, the internal organs. You want to prevent further clot formation and address, again, what I said, the underlying etiology. Etiology meaning what's the cause of the problem. So common approaches include supportive care, use pharmacologic therapies, and sometimes surgery. So you can do a thrombectomy or an embolectomy. Those are pretty rare in veterinary medicine. They can be done. It also is going to depend on, one, the overall health and state of the animal, and also the location, and also the finances of the people that own the animal. So supportive care might mean some physical therapy, such as, let's say, massaging the legs of an animal. If an animal can't move, then you have to, every couple, 3-4 hours, roll the animal over so it doesn't get pressure sores, because animals can develop pressure sores like human beings. And the use of pharmacologic therapies such as antithrombotic treatments, which are treatments such as aspirin, which will inhibit the clotting via the platelets. Platelets just become a little less sticky with aspirin. As an example, thrombolytics, which are enzyme-based products, which are trying to break down a thrombus or an embolism. and then antibiotics because sometimes you are dealing with an infection. Now, I haven't really talked about diagnosis here. There's quite a bit that can be done in diagnostics with blood testing and clotting profiles. The point of this episode is really just to inform you more of the diseases, sort of give you a generic overall overview. But that's true, too, of the diagnostics, that there are multiple diagnostics. Now, they might not tell you exactly what's going on with the underlying disease or the primary etiology, but it will give you an idea of what's going on with the clotting factors, platelets and such. And to cap this off, there's two things. I want to tell a quick story. Some people, you know, I'm from an older generation at this point, which is a really strange thing to say, but I grew up, we watched Bugs Bunny when we were kids, and there was a famous man called Mel Blanc, who was the voice of Bugs Bunny. He was the voice of Daffy Duck. He was the voice of Elmer Fudd. Voiced hundreds of different characters back in the day. Anyway, when he was elderly, he had a son, and the son noticed that his dad wasn't doing so well and recommended his father go into the hospital. And his father had pneumonia. He was hospitalized for the pneumonia and treated for the pneumonia, which was successful. And he was resting in the hospital. And horrible, in my mind, fascinating story, because he was in a hospital bed, and hospital beds have sides to them, and they have side rails. And unfortunately, one, I believe it was an evening, a nurse did not put back one of the side rails. Mel fell out of bed. And when Mel fell out of bed, he broke his femur. And when he broke his femur, he had, unbeknownst to people, at the moment, multiple fat emboli were released from the bone marrow. And when that happens, just like I had mentioned, those emboli are going to be released. They're going to get into the bloodstream, and they're going to end up in a location where the material is going to form a plug. At some point, the blood vessels are going to shrink down, small and small and small. That piece of fat is going to travel through until it acts like a plug. And when that happens, that's going to be a catastrophe. And unfortunately, Mel died because of the broken femur, which to me points out two things. Number one, obviously, it's the disease process. I mean, this is a horrible thing that happened to this man. But two, for us in the veterinary profession, the little things that we do sometimes can have huge potential catastrophic consequences if we don't do them. And a lot of people might brush it off and say, oh, it was just the side of the bed. Yeah, but it ended up causing the demise of a human being, which is a horrible thing for me to even, it's very hard to contemplate. I would feel incredibly, I just can't imagine how bad I would feel if I knew that I was that person, that nurse that didn't put up the side rail. So for us, it just means triple check. In my mind, I always keep that story in my mind, and I say, you have to triple check stuff, even if you think you did it. The split second it takes to triple check something is not really that big of a deal versus could an animal fall out of a cage. You have animals in the tiered caging system that's common in many hospitals, the stainless steel cages with the wire front doors. Sometimes with all the tubes, with all the bedding that's in there, the blankets and whatnot, you don't actually shut that and pull back against it. Sometimes it's not really actually shut. It might appear to be shut. It might be closed, but it's not locked. What happens if that cat falls out and breaks a leg? Okay. So it is possible. So I think for us, being thorough, consistent, and triple checking what you do is the best policy that will keep you out of harm's way as much as possible. And one other mention here, sometimes in veterinary medicine, especially in a critical care, and especially for younger patients, very young patients, it's hard to get access, vascular access. If we're going to give IV fluids, we need vascular access. And sometimes an animal is in shock, and it might be in hypovolemic shock, or it might be in cardiogenic shock, or it could be septic shock. And it's at the end or getting towards the end of that process. And instead of, for example, the blood pressure being elevated, the blood pressure is low. and the heart rate is low and the respiratory rate is low. So if the blood pressure is low, you're going to have a hard time raising a blood vessel to put in a catheter. Now, we can do a cut down, which you have to do a small incision over the skin, over the blood vessel, and then gain access, which is possible. But sometimes there's a procedure called intraosseous or IO fluids. And young animals, remember, their bones are a little softer. They haven't completely formed yet, so they're not completely calcified. There's a lot of calcification, but there's also there's cartilage up high with a bone, generally at the ends of the bone, which has not completely formed yet. And in the proper location, you can drive a needle through there and give intraosseous fluids. When you push that needle in there and then you give IV fluids, and especially if you're pushing IV fluids hard in there, you can drive out fat and you can cause an emboli. So one of the consequences, one of the adverse events occurring from intraosseous fluids is embolization, fat embolization. So our profession is also has techniques that can create, that's iatrogenic, that's doctor created, nurse technician created, what have you. Doctor, basically doctor created emboli. So we are not immune to the problems that also occur in human beings. Okay, so I will put up several links. There's some good articles if you want to dive into this a little bit deeper. All right, everybody, I thank you for listening. Welcome back, and I'll see you again soon. Take care.